I want to welcome you to the April 4th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that usually comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Today marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., who is perhaps the most dedicated pursuer of justice in America in our lifetimes. On another April 4th, 51 years ago, and a year to the day before he would be gunned down in Memphis, King made a major speech against the Vietnam War, which has been largely erased from history by our mainstream media, as it has from the history texts of our nation's public schools. In that speech, which many believe led to his death, King broke a promise to President Johnson to stick to civil rights and keep his mouth shut about the war, but having been shown photographs of what American forces had done to the people of Vietnam, King told a packed crowd at New York's Riverside Church he could no longer keep silent. He spoke passionately that day not only about the injustices of the Vietnam War, but also of the other criminal activities that had been committed by the self-selected leader of the free world, declaring that the United States is, quote, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, end quote. A half century later, with the U.S. engaged to some degree in at least seven wars, the truth of King's conclusion that day cannot be challenged. In 1935, 53 years earlier, former Marine General Smedley Butler, a two-time Medal of Honor winner, put it another way, quote, "War is just a racket," he wrote. "I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service. During that period, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism," end quote. Well, that was the way my guest later today on Takes on the World, Major Danny Scherson, introduced his latest article yesterday on antiwar.com titled "Unbridgeable Gap, Who We Were and Who We Thought We Were," the point of his article being that, quote, "American soldiers were led to believe they fought for democracy and freedom these past 17 years. The truth was far murkier," end quote. It is one of a number of articles that Major Scherson has written in recent days on the antiwar.com and Truth Dig websites related to America's ongoing wars and the public and Congress's deplorable response to them. I last spoke to Major Scherson on September 17th on the same subject, and being, it seems, on the eye of perhaps another and far wider major war in the Middle East, I am looking forward to renewing my conversation with him at 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned for that. On several of my programs since the first of the year, you have heard me refer to an unprecedented, comprehensive secret agreement signed last December 12th between the intelligence agencies of Israel and the U.S., designed to target Iran and all of its activities at home in Syria and in Lebanon. The existence of the deal was revealed on Israeli television December 28th. And after having confirmed in Washington that the story was accurate by the English-language Times of Israel the very same day. Then more than 3 months later, the story is yet to be revealed by a single American news outlet, should raise, if not answer, questions about who and what are controlling the U.S. media. What has since made the ongoing silence by the media of that story even more sinister is that in recent weeks, two of the last three members of President Trump's cabinet who opposed the U.S. decertifying of the multi-nation agreement with Iran to reduce and freeze its nuclear enrichment, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, were unceremoniously fired and replaced by two unbridled war hawks, CIA Director Mike Pompeo and former U.S. UN Ambassador John Bolton, respectively. The fired two, by no coincidence, were both targets of the man who is clearly pulling the president's strings when it comes to his Middle East policy. That's Jewish mega-billionaire and Las Vegas casino owner Sheldon Adelson, who contributed at least $35 million to Trump's election campaign and reportedly was primarily responsible for the president's decision to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and selecting Bolton to be his national security advisor. Bolton's interviews on Fox News and op-ed articles in the New York Times and Wall Street Journal calling for bombing both Iran and North Korea have frightened members of both parties as well as the editorial boards of the major newspapers who have denounced the appointment editorially as one of the worst any president has made. To be sure, the selection of Bolton was welcome in Israel, where it is no doubt remembered that while serving as George Bush's U.N. ambassador, he was hailed by Israel's U.N. ambassador, Dan Gillerman, as, quote, the sixth man in our office. What Adelson may have admired in Bolton is not only his devotion to Israel, but that he, like Adelson, has voiced support for bombing Iran, although he has not gone so far as Adelson himself, who 5 years ago, in a public forum in New York, called for the U.S. to drop a nuclear bomb on Iran to get its attention and compliance with U.S. demands. As the Times of Israel reported on October 24, 2013, quote, American Jewish billionaire Sheldon Adelson said the United States should detonate a nuclear bomb in the Iranian desert to display toughness, though without hurting a soul, before the next stage of negotiations with Tehran. It should then threaten that the next bomb would fall on Tehran, he said. What are we going to negotiate about? Adelson told a crowd at New York's Yeshiva University. According to the paper, Adelson said, what I would say is, listen, you see that desert out there? I want to show you something. You pick up your cell phone, you call somewhere in Nebraska, and you say, okay, let it go. And so there's an atomic weapon, goes over ballistic missiles, the middle of the desert, that doesn't hurt a soul. Maybe a couple of rattlesnakes and scorpions or whatever. And then you say, see, the next one is in the middle of Tehran. So we mean business. That's Sheldon Adelson. Well, you can still see this online, as well as another video of Adelson speaking to an audience of English-speaking Israeli Jews in July 2010, when he announced the launch of his free newspaper, Israel Hayom, which since has become Israel's most widely read periodical. Yeah, it's free. Huh? In this video, he reveals for all to see that loyalty is to Israel. In a wide-ranging talk describing his vision for the paper, which solidly backs Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Adelson said he wished he had served in the Israeli army rather than the U.S. military, and that he hoped his young son will come back to Israel and be, quote, be a sniper for the IDF, a reference to Israel Defense Forces. I am not an Israeli, he said. The uniform that I wore in the military, unfortunately, was not an Israeli uniform. It was an American uniform, although my wife was in the IDF, and one of my daughters was in the IDF. Our two little boys, one of whom will be bar mitzvah tomorrow, hopefully he'll come back. His hobby is shooting. He'll come back and be a sniper for the IDF, end quote. Well, he goes on, all we care about is being good Zionists, being good citizens of Israel, because even though I'm not an Israeli born, Israel's in my heart, he said toward the end of his talk. Now imagine, if you will, what would be going on in the minds of U.S. veterans and members of the military and their families who voted for Donald Trump if they were to listen to or watch Adelson apologize for having served in the U.S. Army while at the same time he appears to be dictating U.S. policy in the Middle East and pushing the country into another far more dangerous war on Israel's behalf. But Adelson, Trump, and Israel have nothing to worry about, at least for the moment, because the media is almost as much under the thumb of Israel and its U.S. lobby as is Congress. Even though the revelation that Adelson prefers Israel to the United States would no doubt help the Democrats gain control over both the House and Senate in the elections this fall, they wouldn't think of using it, fearing, no doubt, that it would provoke a wave of anti-Semitism, and that, for party leaders, is more problematic than the U.S. launching another devastating Middle East war. On a closely related subject, the candidate for the British Labour Party has been viciously attacked by the Jewish Board of Deputies in London, the self-appointed spokesperson for the country's 300,000 Jews, for condoning anti-Semitism within the party, if not being an anti-Semite himself. To press the point, on last Saturday, NPR's Weekend Edition, Scott Simon allowed the head of the Jewish Board of Deputies, Jonathan Arkish, to bash Corbyn and the Labour Party without offering the accused a chance to respond or any indication by Simon that such an effort had been made. Simon, who was apparently using the copy from the New York Times, noted that, quote, the controversy burst out when Mr. Corbyn retweeted a picture of a mural in East London that depicts caricatures of Jewish bankers playing a game of Monopoly on the backs of the world's poor. Mr. Corbyn has apologized and said he should have looked more closely at the mural. The controversy is not just about artwork and raises questions about anti-Semitism and Britain's left wing, said Simon, before introducing Jonathan Arkush, president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews. Let's stop here for a moment. There is and was nothing anti-Semitic about that mural, which was painted on a London wall 6 years ago, and though it has since been painted over, it can still be viewed online. It does indeed show six bankers playing Monopoly on the backs of the backs of the world's poor, but only two of them happened to be Jewish. Unless J.P. Morgan and John Rockefeller were secretly Jews, not to mention Aleister Crowley, who was a well-known anti-Semite. Of course, one of them would be Mayor Rothschild, who with his son controlled the banking of Frankfurt, while his other four sons ran the main banking houses in Britain, France, Austria, and Naples in the 19th century. Without apparently bothering to look in the mirror himself, Simon left NPR's listeners with the image of a group of Jewish bankers with exaggerated racist stereotypes sitting around a Monopoly board counting their money. Curiously, when the mural appeared 5 years ago, the Board of Jewish Deputies expressed no objections. Arkush then complains that, quote, "We have had a succession of anti-Semitic discourse and incidents inside the Labor Party, and all we've had is words Jeremy Corbyn saying that I abhor racism, but he's done nothing about it. And this week, the patience of the Jewish community in Britain finally ran out." End quote. When Simon asked for other instances of anti-Semitism on the left, Arkush brings up the case of Ken Livingstone, former mayor of London. "He has," says Arkush, "come out in the past 2 years with a nonsensical but very provocative statement that Hitler supported Zionism. So he's tried to bracket support for Israel with Zionism. It took a year before they put him through a disciplinary process, and he was suspended from the party for a year. That was a slap of the wrist. He should have been thrown out," end quote. Well, the truth was that from 1933 to 1939, before World War II, Hitler did support Zionism because its goal of persuading Germany's Jews to move to Palestine coincided with Hitler's desire to rid Germany of non-Aryan, and particularly its Jewish population. Thus, the only Jewish organizations that were allowed to function in the Third Reich were those of the Zionists who represent a small minority of Germany's Jews. What was critical, however, was the plan agreed to by the Zionists in Palestine and the Nazis, referred to as the Havera, or transfer agreement, that was administered by Adolf Eichmann. It allowed German Jews who wished to leave to buy German goods with what money they had, which was then shipped on German ships to Palestine, at which point the new Jewish arrivals would claim and resell the goods. In addition, Eichmann, who was in charge of the operation on the German side, allowed young Jews who planned to go to Palestine to learn farming techniques before they embarked. All of this is well documented and common knowledge in Israel, but largely kept a secret outside of it. Those like former London Mayor Ken Livingstone who reveal the secret pay a price, as some years back did Colin Edwards, a former correspondent for the Canadian Broadcasting Company, who was fired by the manager of KALW in San Francisco under pressure from the local Israeli Council General and pro-Israel San Francisco supervisor Quentin Kopp for telling the very same story you just heard here a moment ago. Back on NPR, Scott Simon pointed out that Corbyn and Livingstone have said they are pro-Palestinian, proudly and historically, but they don't consider their opposition to Israel's policies in the Middle East as anti-Semitic. "Well, we never claimed it was," Arkush responded, "but the mural that you referred to depicted grotesquely anti-Semitic caricatures of Jews. Those caricatures came straight out of the Nazi playbook when Israel didn't exist. That has nothing to do with the conflict in the Middle East. This has everything to do with hatred of Jewish people for being Jewish. That's anti-Semitism." So Arkush had the last word, and it wasn't true. Neither Simon nor Arkush acknowledge that there are a significant number of Jewish supporters of Corbyn in the Labor Party who are not buying the anti-Semitic charge and claim it is only being raised to prevent the election in Britain of a pro-Palestinian prime minister. NPR was no better when it came to its reporting on the killing by Israeli soldiers of 17 nonviolent Palestinian protesters and wounding of another 1,500 in response to a peaceful march by Palestinians in Gaza on Friday, demanding their right to return to the homeland from which they were dispossessed in 1948. No Israelis were injured, while videos taken at the scene showed Palestinians, including a woman and a young child, shot dead in the back while retreating from tear gas. Those deaths were not accidental, according to a tweet at 1 p.m. Saturday by the Israel Defense Forces. "Yesterday," it read, "we saw 30,000 people. We arrived prepared and with precise reinforcements. Nothing was carried out uncontrolled. Everything was accurate and measured, and we know where every bullet landed," end quote. The tweet acknowledging, what would be war crimes was later deleted, but not before it was captured and shared worldwide. NPR's media watchdog group FAIR has noted throughout the years takes a default pro-Israel line when reporting on the affairs of Israel and Palestine. Its correspondents almost always live in West Jerusalem or in Israel proper, are rarely Palestinian or Arab, and they work consistently to deflect blame for Israeli violence, either shifting blame onto Palestinian victims or dispersing it through false parody. A segment from Friday's All Things Considered, as FAIR's Adam Johnson points out, provides a case study in this process. NPR host Ari Shapiro sets up the segment, an interview with reporter Daniel Estrin, by blaming the dead-injured Palestinian on, quote, the militant group Hamas, framing Israel as totally defensive. From the very first line, blame is deflected from the Israeli military, in which listeners were told by Estrin they were responding to firebombs thrown by Palestinian militants. When FAIR pointed out to Estrin on Twitter that he had reported the firebombs as fact and not a claim by the IDF, he responded, "I reported the firebombs as an Israeli claim," end quote. When FAIR showed evidence he and host Ari Shapiro had done the opposite, Estrin deflected, "Be kind, it's live radio," end quote. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks very much for listening.